to order. So we'll move on, we'll get the quorum, we'll discuss the minutes. Oh my goodness.
Where is this?
Jim Clark, Representative Mariani, can you come take the gavel, please?
Oh, you can trust me.
Oh.
Folder.
So let me know when we're at the quorum and we'll do things official. Chair Cass and I, welcome to the committee, the testimony for House File 2010. We don't have a quorum, so we're not going to move anything at this point. But we are on the record, and I think it's appropriate for us to begin presentation of the bill and testimony on behalf of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. This is the Local Correctionary Officers Disciplinary Procedure Act as established. This is already in statute for most law enforcement, all law enforcement, and it just brings the local custody officers up to parity with their local law enforcement. With that, I will turn it over to Gus Fromke to go into more details.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members
of the committee. Good morning. Welcome, Mr. Fromke. Please give us your name for the record and then proceed.
Gus Fromke with Teamsters Local 320.
Good to see you.
Thank you very much. The genesis of this bill came to us from our correction officers. We represent 27 jurisdictions in the state of Minnesota, correctional officers who work for sheriff's departments. We had a meeting with MPPOA when Mr. Methusalem was the executive director last spring, and it was brought to his attention as well that correctional officers do not have the same rights and protections under statute as law enforcement officers, licensed peace officers. And essentially, there's just no good reason that correctional officers don't have the same rights and protections under statute that law enforcement peace, licensed peace officers have. And we just want to make sure that local correctional officers who work for sheriff's departments and local jurisdictions have the ability to have the same rights and protections under the disciplinary statutes as licensed peace officers. I'm going to defer the rest of my time to Mr. Onstead, who is a correctional officer in Ramsey County.
Very well. Good morning, Mr. Onstead. Welcome to the committee. Please give us your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Hello, my name is Brett Onstead. I'm a correctional officer here in Ramsey County, and I also am a steward for the Teamsters.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Just to speak from my history, I've been a correctional officer for 25 years and a steward for the last 17 years. In that time, I've had to defend myself, and I've had to defend others who have been accused mostly by inmates. And we're in the trenches with the inmates on a daily basis. They get to know us. They know who we are. And when we're doing our job, it's sometimes the only way that they have is a retaliatory measure against us is to lay claim that we've done something inappropriate. In light of PREA, Prison Rape Elimination Act laws, it's become increasingly easier for them to make claims. All the claims are investigated as they should be. However, I've had to go in with officers, myself included, not knowing what we're being investigated for, what we've been accused of, with no ability to truly defend ourselves as the rest of the public does, as peace officers do. And this law would give us parity with them, to give us that protection. This is a very stressful job. You're dealing with the same people that are being kept off the street on a regular basis. We're having to deal with them on a daily basis. And we're hoping that this is a way for them to cause us stress, to increase our job load. And what we're hoping is that this law will ease some of that burden on the officers, to make it fair on the officers when they're being accused. As I said before, sometimes we're going into a hearing investigation with no prior knowledge other than we're being investigated. Sometimes we're even brought to an off-site location, which can be very disheartening and very confusing. Sometimes if you're a officer working a midnight shift, it might be at the end of your shift when others are going home at the end of the day, because that's convenient for management. So we're hoping that this law will get passed, this in order to alleviate some of those pressures on the officers. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Onston, and thank you for your service to my county, Ramsey County. Chair Considine.
I just want to make it clear, there's nothing in here that's not already in their contract. Discipline is subject to PELRA. We're just putting it into law.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, very well. Who's going to offer it?
Yeah. Right. We can offer it now.
Chair Considine, committee staff informs me that there is an amendment with the bill. Came in a little late, so I don't think we can act on it. But it might be, my understanding is that it's your amendment. It might be good to share about it, and we can certainly ask legal staff to help us with that as well. Just so, you know, it's on the record, and when you bring it back, you're primed and ready, and members are fully informed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I actually don't have it in front of me. Could you read? Thank you. I don't want to mess up.
And while you do that, let me just ask Mr. Franke very quickly. We just heard from Ramsey County. Can you give us a sense of concerns, realities that correction officers are facing in other counties across the state? Or are we dealing with a uniquely Ramsey County corrections issue?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Correctional Officer Onstead was very accommodating to us today to come and testify on behalf of all correctional officers at the local level. And just so you know, correctional officers at the Sheriff's Department work side by side with sheriff's deputies. Sheriff's deputies already have these rights codified in the law, in the statute. And it was brought to our attention that when they are, when there's alleged problems with a correctional officer or a sheriff's deputy, those allegations and the procedures are different. And our position is that's completely unfair and unnecessary when correctional officers are the ones in the jails working with inmates who have been apprehended or are already convicted. And it is a serious issue, and it is it's a serious inequity we see throughout the system.
Very well. Chair Considine.
Just a moment, Mr. Chair. As the chair pointed out, this was posted late, and so Representative O'Neill, do you have an opinion you'd like to express about the amendment, or would you be okay with offering it as a verbal amendment now?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, you have some concerns about the amendment. noticed two of us, two members walked in late because we were standing outside of room 10 wondering where we're meeting. And I was made aware that we were not noticed of meeting change.
We're in a room I'm not familiar with. So back on the record, I have concerns with the amendment. I have concerns with the lateness of it being posted. I have concerns with the meeting change of this or posting where this was. The reason I came in late is because I was standing outside of room 10 not knowing where this meeting was, as was another member and a couple people of the public. So I have great concerns about this entire meeting. I came from another meeting, as most of us are, in several committee hearings today. So, yes, I have concerns with the amendment. Amendment and the way it was posted.
I apologize for the confusion on the meeting location. I actually also started to head for number 10 myself. But we will not propose the amendment today, then, Chair Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't insisting that we did. I just thought.
No, I just thought if we could get it taken care of today and get it done, then sure. That would be great. But that's why I asked Representative O'Neill if she had some concerns. She said she did. We'll just lay it over and, I mean, the amendment and move on.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, there was an email notice of this hearing on dated on March 5th. We're on March.
The location.
We're March 8th.
Until we got approval.
But the location wasn't posted until we got approval from the Senate. So obviously, what's happening right now is that a lot of committees are meeting and rooms are booked, and we're competing for rooms. In fact, I shifted my schedule this week in order to accommodate, not a last minute, but, a more recent announcement by our judiciary chair of wanting to extend it to evening hearings. So it is a little bit of the nature of the beast, and I think, Chair Considine, and you and I will certainly work with our staff to make sure that we're, that they're meeting double time to consistently communicate with our members.
Renew my motion.
Let me. We didn't establish a quorum, so I'm going to say we are at quorum, and therefore, then it's appropriate for us to have a motion on House File 2010. Is this a layover?
Yep.
And. Very, very well. Chair Consular, I believe your motion is to lay over House File 2010 for inclusion in the corrections omnibus bill.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Yes, it is. So moved.
Very well. So the bill is now officially before us. We are acknowledging there's an A1 amendment that did not get in on time. And so, Chair Consular, you'll certainly have an opportunity at a subsequent hearing to be able to debate and move that amendment. Chair Consular, is there any further testimony that you...
Only if there's somebody in the public that wants
is
to.
Is there anyone in the public that wishes to testify on House File 2010? If not, then we are open to questions. And Representative Sirwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just wondering, Representative Consular, if you've heard from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association... if they're supportive or neutral or what their position is on the bill.
Chair Considine.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. They are?
No, they're neutral.
Oh, okay. I've not heard from them at all. Mr. Fromke tells me that they have expressed neutrality on it.
Very well. Are there any other questions? If not, then the chair lays over House File 2010 for possible inclusion in the corrections omnibus bill. Gentlemen, thank you for your presence and your testimony here today. And Chair Considine, you have House File 1948, and I believe your motion is also to lay over House File 1948 for possible inclusion in the corrections omnibus bill.
And there is an amendment on this one also. an author's amendment to get it into the shape that I would like it.
Very, very well. So Representative Considine moves that House File 1948 be laid over for possible inclusion in the corrections omnibus bill. And Chair Considine, so your bill is now officially before us, and Chair Considine moves the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the shape that the author wishes it to be before the committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Chair Considine, House File 1948 is amended as before us.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm actually looking for a report on my phone from the legislative. Commissioner, you want to just come up in case there are some questions? A little over a year ago, last February, I contacted Jim Nobles, the legislative auditor, and asked him to do a life expectancy survey on correctional officers and security counselors. And I have received that back. I would like to disseminate that to you at some point here. But it's rather shocking. There were 74 people that they could not determine for sure what their position was going through the retirement records. But if they were not correctional officers, the average life expectancy of a correctional officer in Minnesota is 67 years old. If they were all correction officers, it bumps it up to 70. Life expectancy for Minnesotans now is right around 81 years. So somewhere between 11 and 14 years shorter than the normal citizen of Mankato. I don't believe your job should come with a death sentence. And so we have been looking for ways besides just having more correctional officers, ways to support them in their job, help them deal with PTSD, stress, anger, trauma. I guess that's redundant with PTSD. I would tell you that anecdotally that they have a very high divorce rate, that there's numerous things of alcohol, drugs, anger issues. You walk into the prison or the security hospital, you're in danger. And unlike soldiers who maybe, while it's a little bit stronger danger, they rotate out, whereas a prison guard or security counselor is there for 25, 30 years, and it builds up. When I left the security hospital in 1989, I took Prozac for 18 months to get my temper under control, because when you are going into something where you are fighting for your life, you need to match that adrenaline. And for the average person, the only way to do that is to get angry. And if you can't, then you're going to lose. But you just cannot control that after a while. So this bill tries to set up some systems within the prison that custody staff can utilize to help deal with these problems. One of the most horrific things that I heard after the Joseph Gomm bill was that a custody staff who had been there that day, had had Officer Gomm's blood on him after he had taken some time off when he got back to the prison, the first person that asked him how he was doing was a resident. That's horrific that the ball was dropped like that. It's also dangerous. There are gangs in prison whose sole purpose is to compromise staff. And if they're getting their support from the residents, then that's a dangerous situation. So we really need to be taking care of these people better. Commissioner Snell, do you have any comments?
Commissioner Snell, good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. This is a, I think this is a, an opportunity for us. As much as we have talked about the importance of the mental health of the people that are inside of our facilities that we house every day, this also becomes, I think, an important piece of the total picture. We do believe, and we have had some discussions with staff around ways that we can, we believe we can provide more support to our staff, to provide them with access to people that can provide these supports. And we think that being able to develop a more of a coordinated plan with regard to how we respond to the needs of our staff does become a value. I will say that this is not unusual to specific even to corrections. In my previous life on the law enforcement front, a number of agencies were focusing more heavily and extensively on the well-being of their own staff, including even proactive kind of mental health check-ins with a provider as a on a proactive basis. So we need to keep these folks healthy. They ultimately have a profound influence on what happens inside of our facilities. And I think ultimately the better we can make it for both our staff as well as the people we house, the safer we all are going to be. And that's in at the end of the day in all of our interests. So this is something that, that we have had discussions about internally. We do think it is important. And I believe what this bill really does is mandates the establishment of this type of a plan.
Very well. Thank you, Commissioner. And I'm recalling our visit that Chair Consul and I had arranged a month ago. Representative Christensen was there. A number of us went to the hearing, Representative O'Neill and Representative Poston. But subsequently, about a week or two later, I think it was a week, there was an informal as members were available. And so three of us were able to do that and have just, you know, very, quite frankly, very personal, sitting in one room together with both inmate residents and with guards. And one of the things I walked away with walked away with that night was this profound sense of the pain and hurt that existed among, our guards and staff at Stillwater. And members, it was quite emotional. I mean, we had grown men sobbing. And I can imagine in that profession, you know, to show that kind of vulnerability isn't something you do lightly. And obviously all this in response to the trauma that was visited the tragedy several months earlier in that institution. And I don't think it took much of a rocket science to figure out that, you know, these human beings could surely benefit from good trauma-informed interventions and presence and guidance. And so I think that, Chair Consul and I'm convinced just from that personal interaction of the wisdom of this approach, and I applaud you, Commissioner, for acknowledging that you were with us that night, acknowledging that, and exhibiting the kind of care and concern you have that we all ought to have for our staff and our corrections officers. And the other thing I walked away from was the sense that, oh my gosh, you know, if there's this kind of, you know, untended pain surely must have an impact, you know, on the professional, safe, you know, operation of this facility. So I think this is a vitally important piece of legislation. And again, I applaud you, Chair Consul, for bringing it forward. Is there any other testimony that you have, Chair Consul?
No, Chair Mariani.
Very well. Is there anyone else in the public that wishes to testify on the bill? If not, we are open for questions. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, Commissioner Schnell, can you tell us what does the Department of Corrections do now when this, like a crisis happens, and how would this plan be different or similar to what you're doing now?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, right now, in the right after the GOM death, there was people brought in. We do have critical incident stress debriefing teams, people within our facilities who do that. We have a number of options, including employee assistance programs, which oftentimes are accessed, but sometimes for people who work in public safety field, that has been difficult because oftentimes they have to explain just what they do and the nature of their work and the environments they work in, and that itself can be difficult for people both in law enforcement and corrections. So we do a much of it based upon circumstances or need as we see it. The challenge around that becomes the fact that oftentimes we know that people may be threatened. They may have bodily fluids tossed on them, and those sorts of things. And many times these folks don't come forward. They don't talk about, identify the challenges that they face as a result of those experiences. And one of the things that I think if we can normalize the fact that talking about those types of experiences and making that something that we should be doing as a matter of course for the good and well-being of ourselves, the people who are working in these facilities and experiencing those things, I think it becomes easier to be more responsive in addressing those problems across the board. What this does, and some of the conversations we've had, is how do we create like local navigators, people in the facilities or even outside that works throughout the DOC system that are peers that can help them navigate. And I've had some experiences with this on the police side, where some law enforcement agencies have established those types of programs. And that has made a tremendous difference. And it's not, frankly, it can be related to the experiences they have had at work, but we also have to face the reality that oftentimes people are struggling with things that are happening in their personal lives. And unfortunately, in environments like prisons, bringing the challenges that we're facing on the outside world into the facility can actually be very disruptive. So the need to kind of help folks navigate the challenges that they may be facing in their own lives really is part and parcel to the safety of what happens in our facilities. And we saw the same thing in policing in many instances.
Chair Mariani?
Chair Constable.
Bring up two examples that probably would got... One, actually, the DOC did respond to. But just recently, one of the custody staff approached some of his peers, and his fiance, he went home from a shift and found his fiance hanging. Well, that didn't happen at work. Probably wouldn't rise up to the level of where the DOC would respond to that without something in place. The other one I would point to is shortly after Officer Parisi died, they had a guy that had been a veteran that had just retired and died in a car accident. It was devastating for the people at Shakopee. Now, the DOC did respond to that one, even though it was outside the prison walls and the guy actually was retired. But it had such an impact on both the residents and the staff. This guy was well-liked and by both groups, and so they did respond to that one. But, you know, sometimes that'd be something that might slip through the cracks.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've toured through all but one now of the prisons, and I always ask about the therapists that are there and the counseling that they do and the treatment that they do. So I have a little bit of understanding, but so would you have internally enough folks that are trauma-informed therapists or counselors that could actually facilitate and be that support, or do you need to hire up, or what are you thinking there, Commissioner Schnell?
Commissioner Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I really don't believe that we're talking about building an entire new system. I think what we really think that this bill can help us do is really direct us to formulate a plan around how we help people navigate in resources that I think maybe certainly are trauma-informed, but also have to providers that have an awareness around the realities of working in facilities, working in public safety environments. And I think having that can make a big difference.
Thank you.
And also establishing a peer, some peers that are already kind of doing this work on their own, a more formalized.
I do have one thing.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I know that you're doing CIT training, which is similar. You know, at least you understand sort of the immediate trauma and crisis, and so you're helping to de-escalate. And I know, but the goal, at least last time I talked to DOC, was about 25% of the officers will be CIT trained. Are those the peers that you're kind of thinking about, or that just sort of occurred to me that you're already doing that training and maybe it could be integrated with a little bit of CIT training, and maybe it already is. I'm not sure. Maybe you could speak to that.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, yes, those people are oftentimes the ones who self-identify as the people who would like to serve more in this critical incident stress debriefing kind of role, as well as just being a navigator to provide support to peers in the workplace. Because of that training, because of that experiences, I think it can be very helpful.
Okay, thank you.
It seems to me, as I listen to the conversation, that another way to think about this focus and effort is to consider it also as a professional development within the professional development framework. So obviously we're talking about safety, people's individuals' mental health, all of that factoring into perhaps development of new skills that are vital for maintaining a safe and well-run facility. Representative Sirwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author of the bill. I like this bill a lot. My only question is, I think it's directed, and obviously with our role it makes sense, it's directed towards the commissioner to develop this response plan for state-run correctional facilities. I'm wondering if upon completion of the plan in the report, if it would be possible to make the plan and the report available to the sheriffs across the state that operate jail facilities. I know two correctional officer and a detention deputy that after being on hand in county facilities witnessed and were a part of pretty significant critical incidents that did kind of escalate into a absence of work, PTSD formation, treatment, both individuals after nearly a month out of work separately, two different agencies were able to, through counseling and other support, return to work. And so this is a significant issue. It's one of the reasons last year when we worked on the PTSD bill together, we worked so hard to include both state and county correctional employees within the confines of the work presumption, employment presumption, PTSD. And so this is a real issue. This is a real and significant issue, and it's something that's in place in our state prison system. It's also in place in our county correctional system as well. And so to the degree, I understand that some of the support mechanisms may not align when you get to the county level, but my hope is that this could be viewed as a roadmap for law enforcement leaders across the state within the county jail system to map out something like this on their own.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, without a doubt, there's no doubt that the need for this is exclusive to the prisons. Certainly, anybody that works in these types of environments are partners in the county jails, and we would be happy to share and collaborate to the extent that we can, even in the development of some of this.
Very well, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we're kind of talking about that and even possibly expanding it and having it be a roadmap, is there any sense as to the appropriation need to accomplish this?
Commissioner Snow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, Representative O'Neill, we are, in fact, I think, looking at the ways in which we might be able to build some of this in our internal capacity. We really, we know that you all will have considerable work to do around budget. We are trying to be as fiscally kind of responsible about this, and we want to try and use internal expertise and resources. We're having some discussions with that. It is going through the process of a fiscal note review. But we're really working with our folks to see what we could do to try and staff this up as we try and work and develop this this coordinated plan. So I don't have the specific answer for you, it is our effort to try and do that to the extent possible with as much and many existing resources as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we talked earlier in the just a few minutes ago, I had asked about any additional staff, and you kind of thought you could do it internally, but then you just said now staff up. So, is there a thought to maybe hire one or two, or what's the conversation,
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill. I mean, right now we are looking at depending upon what this plan ultimately looks like, mm-hmm. and I think that's really the key issue. We are not intending. I don't think we're not trying to establish a unit. But I think as we look at the planning, what capacity do we have inside to be able to either have identify a navigator or using our existing pool of staff look at a model that has navigators in each facility, mm-hmm. which are the kind of the core or central people. That's not their full-time job. It's an adjunct duty to other roles. So we're really trying to think about the ways that we can make it meaningful. And we've had a number of discussions, but really a part of this will be to look at the interface with all of these other kind of resource bodies. As I said, it is our goal to use existing resources to the extent that that's possible, and that may mean shifting resources within the department. At this time, we are not looking at adding additional bodies to do this.
Thank you.
Very well. With that, Representative Consler, I'm going to get the last word before we move on.
I just think this is desperately needed, and as to some of the commissioner's remarks about trying to build the capacity within, because of the unique nature of working in a correctional facility, I think that's probably the best idea, because they will have a really good understanding of what they're dealing with, whereas if you try to bring somebody in from the outside, if there are at some point they decide that they need to maybe see professional help, there are employee assistance programs that they can be referred to, but it's identifying it is the immediate support so that somebody's not and recognizing where the problems are, that is where we're falling short.
Very well. With that, the chair will lay House File 1948 over as amended for possible inclusion in the corrections omnibus bill. Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think we're about to
swap places.
Seats, so.
Thank you.
Oh. Before we proceed, is, I just thought I'd ask, is there anybody that's interested in seeing that life expectancy report? Okay, yes, 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 yes. Okay, I will forward it to you. It's on my email, so I'll just forward it to everybody that's on the committee. Change that. Jamel will do it and post it as well. Thank goodness you're there. You got it, don't you?
I couldn't find it.
Okay. All right. We have an agenda. Representative Christensen, have you had a chance to review the minutes, and would you like to move them? Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say aye. Okay. Minutes are approved. A little fun. Okay, Chair Mariani, would you like to take over there?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, please. I'd like to move House File 2128 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Corrections Omnibus Bill.
And, proceed.
Very well. And with that, Commissioner Schnell is here to explain more fully. It's really pretty simple on one level. Currently, a person who's serving a mandatory life sentence may get supervised release under certain conditions. This bill would create an indeterminate sentence release board that will be responsible for granting supervised release for such persons. The bill lays out, the structure and conditions, terms, compensation, etc., for such a board, and also then requires a report due to the relevant committees by mid-February of each year. Members, with that explains what the bill does, and we do have commissioners down here who can speak to where this comes from, what the department's thinking is about that, what the need is, and answer any questions that the committee may have.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Though Minnesota is a determinate sentencing state, we still have a few offenses for which release decisions need to be made after the minimum sentences are served. All of these are life sentences. Currently, we have approximately 600 people in Minnesota prisons who are in for life with the possibility of parole. Under current law, the commissioner has the sole authority and discretion to make the decision regarding the release of these individuals. If released, they are on supervision for life. There are many safeguards in place in our law and in the administrative rules that allow for careful review before release decisions are made, and that includes consultation with victims and a public safety risk determination. However, the reality is that these decisions have to be made, not only because it is what the law requires, but it is also because it is our responsibility in the interest of fairness. This issue is also linked directly to prison safety. Some of the life sentenced folks have shared with us, even during the some of the legislative discussions that have occurred, that hope is important to them. Without hope and without fairness in the process, people oftentimes feel they have nothing less to lose, which impacts the safety of our staff and the safety of those inside of our facilities. In this year alone, I will have to review about 70 cases, and we'll need to make decisions for 35 to 40 of those who are eligible to be released when they come before me for consideration of release, and the way it's referred to today is parole. Our projections show that this number will continue to grow over the years, and these decisions need to be made every year by every administration, no matter who is in the executive office. We don't think it's sound policy to have one person make this decision. Minnesota is one of only four states where the commissioner alone is responsible for making decisions about parole rather than having a panel. This proposal would create an indeterminate sentence and release board for those who are in for life with the possibility of parole. There are states with determinate sentencing systems for most offenses who still have parole or review boards making parole decisions for those who are incarcerated for other offenses that do not fall under a determinate sentencing. For example, Washington State, which is most comparable to us, they abolished their parole board when they adopted a determinate sentencing structure. But they also created a separate review board for offenses where the possibility of indeterminate sentencing still exists. Whether or not this board exists, these decisions will need to be made in accordance with Minnesota law. The question for our legislators is, do you feel that the decision should be made by whoever the commissioner is, or do you feel that a better policy is the establishment of a panel of qualified individuals selected from a bipartisan pool of recommended candidates? The decision will need to be made either way. For us, it's about institutionalizing sound policy that ensures that the right people are making these decisions in a transparent process. In the majority of states, the governor appoints those making parole decisions, and the legislature confirms them. Our proposal allows the Senate majority and minority leaders and House majority and minority leaders to recommend names to the governor based on their qualifications defined in the bill. The governor will then choose those candidates. They would also have specific terms. This is very similar to the judicial appointment process, with a committee recommending names to the governor, and the governor selects from among those recommended candidates. Administrative work we already do to prepare for these reviews will still be done by staff from the Department of Corrections, which includes victim notification and preparation of all reports. This proposal does not change what decisions will need to be made, but who makes them, which I think is ultimately the creation of a sounder policy and more transparent policy. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for any questions that you or the committee may have.
Commissioner Snell, I actually have one. last night we discussed the, I believe, 8 individuals that were given life sentences without parole as juveniles. Would they then fall under the preview of this group?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, they would. If they are subject to parole, as long as they have the parole option, yes, they would.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Snell. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just elaborate a little bit more, kind of the question I had asked in the previous bill? So what we're doing now versus this new method, where do you see this being a better way to do it? Or I realize it's different, but can you just kind of your thought process of why bringing this forward, and how is this better or different? Or
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill. Yes, as we looked at this, right now what happens is when those lifers are up for review every month, in fact, next Tuesday afternoon, we will have a lifer review day. It oftentimes is much of the day. There is a comprehensive release team review that is done in each facility where the lifers exist. They create a comprehensive report. A psychologist or a qualified mental health professional interviews them. We look at all their disciplinary history, their involvement in all levels of treatment programming that may have been available to and afforded them throughout the time of their incarceration. We look at any disciplinary issues that may have occurred while they're in prison, and we spend a good deal of time really focusing on their release plan, which we all know becomes critically important as we look to reintegration. They come before us. The victims are oftentimes seen or heard from earlier in the day. And then in the afternoon, we have direct contact with the person who is being considered for parole. There is a discussion that occurs between me and them usually through ITV, so we can see each other. It's a big version of Skype. We have a conversation along with other people from the Department of Corrections who serve as panelists, and that would not, none of that would change. So all of these things would occur. The key difference is that what ends up happening is that we are now bringing in a group of people as opposed to having a single person make this decision, that through by the establishment of this board, a group of qualified folks would be participating in the same process that we use today, making sure that the broadest interests are looked at and reviewed, including the issues around fairness to the person who has served their sentence, and making that decision. And then all of the conditions that get put in place should a parole or release be granted remain under the discretion of the Department of Corrections through the authority granted to the commissioner by Minnesota law. And so we establish all the conditions of supervision, their release, including things like their release to halfway houses, electronic monitoring, and so forth.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if we're going from one person making the decision to a board, then maybe this is for the bill author. So I didn't see anything in the bill, and maybe I missed it, that is this a unanimous vote of the board, or is this a majority vote of the board, or a supermajority, or how is that determined?
It's a great question, and we were just chatting, and the commissioner has some thoughts on that.
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, it is a great question. When we were looking at this bill, there was an oversight. It should be a majority vote of the board. So it need, in this case, three of the five it would be granted. It's a simple majority is how it would work. And that's going to need to be one of the tweaks that we would have to put in this because it was missed during the drafting, I believe.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when we're talking about releasing somebody from prison that's serving life, just a suggestion, maybe you might want a supermajority as opposed to a majority, I think, or maybe even unanimous. I'm just thinking that that's a pretty big decision to be based on the majority of a group. I have a great caution with doing it that way. Just think about that. I just think that you probably want more than just a simple majority on something that's that large of a decision.
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I agree that the gravity of the decision is significant. Today, one person gets to make that decision. And as I said, I want to be really clear about the fact that I'm not concerned about making that decision because I would make it in accordance with the law that's established by this body and others. But I do think that in the broadest interest of community justice, that there is a benefit to having shared governance in the making of significant decisions like this. And most of these decisions, with the exception of pardons, are based oftentimes on a majority of qualified or elected people. And I think that was the reason why that was established. But your point is taken that it is a significant decision.
As I recall, Commissioner Snell, that in a short period of time, we're going to start averaging about five a month that it will be eligible to be heard.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. In fact, right now we are hearing between four and six per month.
Representative O'Neill, you had something else?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that answer that we found in other situations that it was just a simple majority. But the other factor that we need to consider is that we are very, very, very low incarceration state. So the ones that are incarcerated, there's a very good reason why they're incarcerated, and we're talking about the most egregious of those that are incarcerated?
No, I didn't.
So that's where my caution comes, because we're talking about lifers with possibility of parole. But we also need to be considerate of the public safety as well. So it just gives me great pause. to have a simple majority, particularly with the structure of our state. We're not like other states. We only have 10,000 incarcerated out of, you know, 120 or 30, depending on 1,000, depending on the day, that are in underneath the purview of your department. So I still have a great caution even hearing that response. Thank you.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, I have a few questions. Just kind of dig into this a little bit for the bill author, Chair Mariani. Minnesota, along with many other states, went away from a parole board, kind of the traditional parole board, when studies and reports showed kind of implicit bias in individuals being treated differently by parole boards across the country. And so it's an interesting policy proposal to kind of go back to that type of establishment. I'm wondering if you could kind of talk about that a little bit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, I share your historical review and the concern behind it as well. I think, and I'll certainly ask the commissioner here to weigh in on this. I think what has evolved over time, but I'm not certain that I can speak with total knowledge and confidence. But I think what has evolved is a process of intervention that arguably has minimized that and many other biases. So the commissioner spoke about the comprehensive relief term review involving a broad array of individuals covering a number of elements that get at the ability for change, you know, evidence of changed behavior, perspective, in other words, you know, where along a rehabilitation continuum an individual might be. We certainly have gotten better as a society in terms of clinical interventions that involve increasingly inform through multicultural lenses and the ability to place individuals with professionals that are more familiar and inform with the particular background, cultural, racial, and other disability backgrounds that an individual may have. What I don't know is to what degree we've been able to do that. So I think there's comfort, you know, for me in terms of where we've been going in terms of that kind of wisdom, if you will, added into, you know, the review process that the commissioner mentioned. But I would certainly open up to the commissioner to add to that or to refute my claims.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, I couldn't agree more. I mean, that certainly was one of the things that was the objective. I think the one thing that this proposal, I think, minimizes a little bit is the fact that right now it's one person that does that. And that so it is the bias, the potential bias of a single person that could make or break the decisions around someone's release. And I think what this does is it does open that up a little bit broader. And again, I think it is important to note that, you know, Minnesota law does have some instances where there is life without the possibility of parole. And that is the policy of and the law of the state. And in those cases, certainly those people will never have this opportunity.
Representative Zerwas, you had a follow-up?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And I'm wondering if the commissioner could walk us through a little bit of what he was alluding to at the end about what convictions are fall under that life without the possibility of parole, and then some key date changes that changed some of those convictions and how he would propose this new process, if adopted, would handle some of those older convictions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, it is there has been a number of changes over the course of years. So prior to 1980, the minimum imprisonment time in order for parole eligibility was set at 17 years for all first-degree or life-sentenced inmates. Was 17. Between May of 1980 and August of 1989, it was 17 years simply for first-degree murder before parole eligibility. And then in 89 to the present time, the legislature increased the minimum imprisonment time for first-degree murder before parole eligibility to 30 years. So with the exception of treason, which remained a 17-year parole eligibility. In 1989, the legislature also added life without the possibility of parole for conviction of a first-degree murder following the conviction for a heinous crime. And in 92, the legislature added life imprisonment for certain repeat sex offenses, which included the persons convicted of first-degree criminal sexual conduct who had two previous first, second, or third-degree criminal sexual conduct convictions. And the legislature also added life without the possibility of parole for first-degree murder while committing a forcible criminal sexual conduct offense. In 93, the legislature added life without the possibility of parole for killing a police officer or a correctional officer. In 1998, the state legislature added life without parole for murder committed in the course of a kidnapping. And that also intentional homicide committed in the course of a drive-by shooting during that year was also elevated to first-degree murder by the state legislature. And then in 2005, the state legislature added life without parole for first and second-degree criminal sexual conduct offenses involving force, violence, or a dangerous weapon where either two or more heinous elements exist or the offender had a previous sex offense conviction and one heinous element exists. So that's kind of the history of where this is. And so right now what's coming before the board are a number of people who obviously still have the 30-year, and we do have some people who have 17-year minimum parole terms in prison.
Are you follow-up?
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner, thanks for that information, because I think it's important for the committee to be aware of the number and types of convictions that your proposal just wouldn't impact.
Yes.
I have a pretty significant concern about individuals that are coming up on their 30 years that have been convicted of first-degree murder of a police officer, a correctional officer. I'm understanding that the first correctional officer homicide was this year, but first-degree murder of a police officer prior to, I think you said, the 93 change in statute. And having those individuals go before a five-member board where only three votes would be needed. You know, one of the things we don't talk about is the fact that you're appointed by the governor. If you do something bad or something that Minnesotans don't agree with, it's one person, and we hold that one person responsible. And then, generally speaking, it's the one person that gave you your job. And this kind of spreads that out a little bit. And so there is an opportunity in the way this is set up where the Commissioner of Corrections, who chairs this board, could oppose every single parole and release, and every single one could still go through. Right now, if you oppose it, it doesn't happen. So I think there's a little bit of concern. We haven't talked about, and I'm sure it's in the language of the bill, and I'm wondering if this is for the bill author or for the commissioner. For the members appointed, are those terms staggered? How does that work? What's the likelihood that a current governor would have a board, a parole board, comprised of members they did not appoint?
Representative Zerwas, I think it's one member from the House majority, one minority. Will be selecting the candidates and sending them to the governor, and then he gets to pick out of that.
Well, and
isn't that correct, Chair Mariani?
Well, and Mr. Chair, if you look on page 2, it calls for 4-year staggered terms, and then the preceding language, you know, from following 2.1, then begins that staggered term, you know, beginning in 22, then 24. So, yes, I think one of the advantages that provides is the ability to have, you know, as governors move, you know, through time, you know, ownership that's not a partisan ownership over the decisions.
Yep. And then
Representative Zerwas.
One last thought or question. Wondering if the author would be open to the idea, with just a majority vote of the panel, there is a chance that a governor's appointed commissioner of corrections would disagree with the panel's decision. That person would be slated to be released. I'm wondering if the bill author would be open to an amendment that would allow for an emergency off-ramp, or a governor could overrule the parole board recommendation if he or she thought fit, or if a decision was, if 3-2 decision was made, the commissioner of his Department of Corrections votes against the release in this instance and says this is not the right decision, that a governor who would be held responsible ultimately for this decision would have an opportunity to exercise some type of oversight or regulatory role to say, you know what, in this instance, we're not going to go with the majority of the parole board vote. And so I'm wondering if the commissioner has an opinion on that, or if the bill author has a thought on that. I think that would provide some comfort in knowing for a future administration that in a probably a rare case, there would be an opportunity, if they saw fit, to put the train back on the tracks.
Representative Mariani.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to confer with the commissioner, but I'll give you my quick thoughts on it. One is that certainly always open to exploring how our policy proposals can be made stronger. I tried to do that with all my legislation, and so we look forward to that conversation. My quick response or reactions, and they're just really quick ones, is that the commissioner described a pretty rigorous process that has been developed and put into place. And I think what the commissioner is saying is that, along with that, that this really isn't about how the commissioner feels at any given point in time or any individual. And in fact, I think there's arguments both for, you know, releasing an individual or not releasing an individual, where you don't want that to be the deciding filter. You know, someone's, you know, individual predisposition. There's a rigorous process that involves a number of people taking careful steps, including interacting with victims or victims' family, you know, reviewing the history, the behavior, you know, of the felon. And so whatever we do, I mean, certainly open, whatever we do, I would counsel myself and all of us not to let that process be trumped by individual, I'm not quite sure what the word might be, whether it's bias or sentiment or feeling. I also think that, and I do get the issue of, political accountability. I mean, we're all held to that standard. So I think there's an important balance here that you certainly don't want any of our decisions, particularly high-stake decisions in government, to be so removed from those that we've elected to make those decisions. At the same time, the balance to that is you also don't want those decisions to be politically motivated. So absolutely, to explore where that right balance might be and whether it's in this proposal or perhaps, an iteration of it, I'm certainly open to that, but I would invite the commissioner to comment as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, I think it is a legitimate question, and I think one of the things that is here is that nothing would change the commissioner's ability to oversee the process of release, where that what that looks like, the planning of that, the halfway house, the level of supervision, electronic monitoring, all those conditions can be put in place. I think really what's part and parcel to some of the question is really this whole notion, when we talk about accountability and we look at that, is the question around some level of the public's expectation around what does a life sentence mean? And I think that there is an element of this as part of this discussion. And I think one of the challenges for all of us and the public and at large is that oftentimes they hear about a life sentence, which by Minnesota policy is not life in many instances. And I think that becomes the core issue here. The policy of the state is that a life sentence in most instances comes with a 30-year minimum term and then a review at some point in time. And so I think in terms of, just to be clear, the policy of the state is really what governs this and ultimately creates this. As I said, I seek not to try and remove responsibility and accountability. I will make those decisions in accordance with, I think, prudent policy, the levels of the recommendations of the experts that have assessed these folks, and certainly with an absolute eye toward public safety. That's key and critical. I think that it can be oftentimes influenced. And if we look over history, oftentimes parole was grounded in ideology as opposed to core and key kind of correctional principles in accordance with Minnesota's policy around the minimum term of what a life sentence is.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. We have three more people on the list. I want to interject something else. I'm not impugning the commissioner's credentials as Superman, but 5 to 7 of these a month and running the Department of Corrections, I think that's quite a bit to ask. I'm a little concerned about the workload that these bring to the commissioner in addition to his regular duties, where if you have a parole board, just throwing that out. That's my own personal thought.
But I think, Mr. Chair, just really quickly, unless I'm misunderstanding the legislation, he would be the chair of the board.
He would, but it would spread out the duties. And I believe, my personal belief is that they don't take this lightly, that this takes a lot of work, and that if you had this spread out among a board, you could, like that idea.
Well, I think if he has one vote or one of five votes, I assume the commissioner's going to put as much thought and process into it either way. Staff is doing the interviews and preparing the reports, whether it's going to the commissioner or to a board of five. There's a lot of arguments to be made for perhaps going in a direction like this. I don't think the workload aspect is one of them.
Well, okay. Representative Vogelmont.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I was wondering if you would be able to comment on the history of the incarceration rate in Minnesota, and maybe give us some context of how it relates to the number of people who are now eligible for supervised release, and if you could also comment on how that would impact people of color, and if there are any racial disparities over the history of sentencing here in Minnesota.
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. I mean, I think we know, and it's not exclusive to Minnesota by any stretch of the imagination, that over the course of history, there has been profound disparities in the criminal justice system with a heavy overrepresentation of people of color in the system in general. As was pointed out rightly, Minnesota does have a very low incarceration rate compared to other states around the country, and I think that speaks well for our state. It speaks well for the people who have been working in corrections and really trying to address problems as much as they can as early on. That said, I think when we look at this board, ultimately, again, the numbers of people that we have in prison for these types of offenses, life-term offenses, is grounded in the state's policy, in the state's law, the ability of the courts to impose sentences, and certainly that the limitations can be established and are established by the legislature, and that really guides the people who are in prison for these life term sentences. So it's really more about the sentencing, not necessarily the proportion of people in our prisons. That said, if we have disparities or bias that ultimately resulted in higher numbers of persons of color coming before us, and I don't know the exact racial makeup of the number of people coming before the commissioner at this point in time for parole review, but I believe that I think it would be pretty safe to say and assert, just based on our population in general, that there's a likelihood that that would be a considerably higher number of people of color.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, testifiers. So I'm wondering if you just clarify I'm trying to envision the process here. So we're going to have four legislators, is that right? And then you would be the chair, and I see that your mind is going here. So I'm just wondering, we're living through this dizzying pace of being a legislator right now, so I'm wondering what the actual process is going to be. Is this going to be done online? Is it, I guess just elaboration on that. Are the legislators going to end up being more of an advisory board to you, the commissioner? If you could just explain that a little bit, please. Thanks.
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the way this would work right now is that the House majority-minority and Senate majority and minority leaders would identify candidates that would fall within the parameters established by the law, by way of background and knowledge and expertise, and they would then be submitted to the governor. The governor would select from the candidates identified by the respective leaders, House and Senate majority and minority leaders.
They wouldn't necessarily be legislators.
No. Oh, okay. Okay. So that I would, that would have worried me a little bit if we had
No chance you're going
to. Yeah, I love you all, but yeah. Okay. So there is a likelihood that some legislators may be recommended. Part of my question here was about the fact that how many of us legislators would meet the criteria. We'd have a lot of lawyers, I think, on the board. So that was part of my question. But I don't have any more to ask. That clears it up for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of quick questions for you, Commissioner. Can you just tell us again how many inmates are in our correctional system that are sentenced to life?
Commissioner Snow.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think, if I'm not mistaken, don't quote me exactly, but I think it was 656 when between men and women. And again, some of those have life without the possibility of parole, and the majority have life with the possibility.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you're seeing reviewing five or seven of these cases a month. How many current inmates with life sentences are being released in a year, let's say, currently?
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's hard for me to say because I don't have a big historical perspective, obviously. But about 35 to 40, I think we said, of those are really, because some of them, we really see them at 20, the first time they come before review is at 27 years. We have a conversation. We begin to look at what has been their history, what treatment programs have they completed, all the adjustment questions. We really start talking about release planning because ultimately that is what the role is of corrections is to make sure that we ultimately return people to the community by reducing and reducing the likelihood of recidivism. So at 27, we do that, but 35 to 40 people a year are actually eligible to be released. But I will tell you that it is a comprehensive process. I think, you know, speaking to the kind of the gravity of it, I certainly don't want to be wrong. Nobody wants to be wrong, mm-hmm. Especially when it comes to these decisions. At the same time, having just spent as much time as I have and knowing some of these people, even my previous experience of working doing case management is just out of college with people who had served life terms at the time, then 17 years. Many of these people who have committed these offenses are not the same people 30 plus years later. They, in some cases, as you all heard last night, some of them are going in as juveniles, certainly many as 18-year-olds, and now as people who are 50 or 60 or 70 years old, they are entirely and wholly different people. And I think in accordance with the law, making the decisions around parole has to be based upon what they've done and our ability as the Department of Corrections or our Community Corrections Act partners to reasonably supervise them and do everything we can to ensure the safety of the public.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Poston. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have some statistics from January 1st, 2019. Directly from Department of Corrections website. So according to your website, there were 610 total lifers. 140 of them are sentenced to life without parole. So that's the numbers you have on your website as of the 1st of January. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no more questions, Chair Mariani, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I also want to encourage us to continue having this conversation and, you know, to keep in mind that there's nothing new that's being created in terms of conditions of release. We're working within, you know, state law and state policy that says for many of these individuals, certainly the ones who are serving with a parole a possibility, that it is our responsibility to do due diligence at the highest level of rigor in considering their release at the end of that term. The governor still appoints. The commissioner is still there. The accountability still exists. I think part of what's being added here is the ability for the broader community to have ownership over this deliberation, whatever the outcome might be, and that that ownership is still done and maintained within a high level of rigor, which also accentuates the importance of hope in our society and hope within this population, which, you know, provides all sorts of benefits for the communities in which they reside in our facilities. So I hope we continue this conversation and take this proposal quite seriously, and look forward to our ability to continue to do that. So, yes, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess the chair can move to lay over.
Okay, will this bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill? We'll endeavor to do better as far as communications. Last night I had three committees all meeting at the same time myself. Yeah, I'm sensitive to what you're saying. Sometimes it's difficult, and we'll try to do the best we can. Did you want to make a comment? You pulled the microphone down. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in light of that, do you have a roadmap for next week so that we can kind of plan in advance?
We're just going to meet on Wednesday.
All right.
All right, so far.
Okay. Okay, just on Wednesday, and then room 10?
Room 10.
Thank you.
It
wasn't just me.
No, it wasn't just
you. It was another member, and members of the public were all confused as to where we were headed. And
oh, if it hadn't been the text I got from Adam about 8:30, I might have been over there with you.
Well,
so, yes, it's
that's problematic. Thank you, sir.
We race towards those deadlines. Okay, without further ado, we are adjourned.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.